We will bring the other speakers up, if I could, and I'm going to ask Dr. Pat McGrath, who's Director of Surgical Oncology in the Division of General Surgery at the University of Kentucky, to also join the group. Okay, we've got a number of great questions here. Dr. Kroesch, let's start with you. Do you routinely mesh reinforce patients that you achieve tissue closure with modified or regular component separation? If so, do you fixate to the posterior rectus sheath laterally?
Short answer, no.
Okay.
My primary goal is to avoid using prosthetic mesh. Okay. For these complex abdominal wall reconstructions now, not for a garden variety inguinal hernia or something like that.
Do you have a weight limit that you put on these people? Or do you have any type of BMI expectations of these folks?
Considering that one of the more recent reports that Memphis has now become the largest city in the country.
Literally.
Part of that occurred after, New Orleans held that distinction for a long time, and then when Katrina came through, a lot of the people from New Orleans relocated in Memphis, because Memphis is such a swinging place, but it's now has the highest mean BMI in the country. Now, that being said, the things that I really try to emphasize to the patients are, one, quit smoking. About a quarter of them do. Ask them to try to get them to lose weight, but there's a litany of reasons why they can't lose weight, so they don't. But the one thing in the morbidly obese patients where we do these abdominal wall reconstructions, the one thing you don't have to worry about is having enough skin to close in the midline, right? Because you've got bucket loads of that. But the problem is when they're laying in the bed, Sir Isaac Newton and the gravity of their big skin flaps that you've just made, it pulls them apart. So I try to get them to lay prone. They don't like that very much, but if they don't do that, then we just take the sheets off their bed and make sure they spend most of their time up in the chair with a binder on. I'm kidding about the take the sheets off the bed part.
Dr. Fitzgibbons, comments? You didn't put down one of the risk factors for recurrence as weight and BMI. Do you feel that it's not important, or what do you talk to your BMIs of greater than 50 patients about their inguinal hernias?
Well, that really does not hold up for inguinal hernias. It certainly does for abdominal wall hernias.
Yeah.
But actually, there are some studies that show that obesity is a good predictive factor. So I don't consider obesity to be a big problem. It's harder for the surgeon, but the recurrence rate is not higher.
So for inguinal hernias, the groin hernias, you do not have any sort of weight expectations on them?
No.
Okay. Dr. Kroesch, back to you on the component separation procedure. It appears to denervate the rectus muscle. Has this resulted in any problems with abdominal wall protuberance or weakness?
I realize that the innovation comes really T7 through T11 or so, and that this does theoretically should denervate the rectus. I can tell you, just based on the fact that we follow these patients, that their rectus doesn't die and they live normal lives. Whether that's because, again, you don't completely free up the rectus laterally, right? Because you can't go below the arcuate line, and then you're limited, dependent on where the costal margin is. So maybe it's just you lose a couple of segments of the intercostals as they come around, and that's enough to keep the rectus alive. I'm not really sure. I don't have a good answer, except that I can tell you that their rectus doesn't die, and these people can do. Now, this particular population of patients in general, they're not out doing a bunch of sit-ups. But they live normal lives. I mean, they live normal lives. It's kind of hard to improve on living a normal life. I have had the occasion to reoperate on a couple of these people, like for bowel obstruction or something. You go through the midline, and it's just like a regular, reoperative abdomen.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting what you're telling us there, because the nerves come between the transversus abdominis muscle and the internal oblique. That's where they enter. And we're now, the abdominal wall reconstruction people are now doing many more posterior component separations, and we take great pains to go between the transversus fascia and peritoneum and the transversus abdominis muscle. And the way to do that is to divide the transversus abdominis muscle, and I'll show that this afternoon in another talk. But if we could go in that plane between the internal oblique and the transversus abdominis muscle, this would be a much, much easier operation, because that peritoneum and transversus fascia is so thin in a posterior component separation that you often have holes and you have to deal with that. So if you could get away with this and not denervate the muscle, that's been the reason why we haven't done it, because we're worried about denervating the muscle. So it's very interesting.
I can just tell you that that they do okay. Again, maybe it's just because it's short segments, because you don't go, inferior to the arcuate line. And I always cheat, probably a few centimeters cephalad to the arcuate line just to make sure that I don't go below.
Okay. Dr. Northfeld, for those of us that don't do oncology on a regular basis, what do you mean by complete pathologic response?
The pathologists will say that we've achieved complete pathologic response when they can't find any viable cancer in the surgical specimen. So they will describe, for example, necrosis and various other features that convince us that we've killed the cancer, but they're also on the lookout for cancer cells that appear to retain their viability. Take up the stain normally, have the normal morphology. If they see those, then we haven't achieved a complete pathologic response. So I'm not a pathologist, and I can't offer you a more detailed explanation than that, but our pathologists report there's cancer there or there's not cancer there.
In Rochester, they're very careful, and I think you alluded importantly to looking at not only the primary tumor but also the lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. And so for a PCR, a complete pathologic response, all of the invasive cancer has to be gone. But there's been a debate about, do you have to have all of the DCIS to be gone? And if you're talking about survival, the DCS, it's okay to call a PCR with DCIS still present. If you're talking about ultimately what you want to do, and that is put us out of business and completely wipe out all the cancer and not have surgeons go back, then you'd have to define PCR with all tumor gone. But right now, in terms of survival, you can still have residual DCIS, just not invasive cancer.
Let me ask the group then also about sentinel lymph node biopsies. Should they be performed prior to neoadjuvant?
In the practice at Mayo in Arizona, and I think this is also the practice in Rochester and Florida as well, if there's a palpable concern in the axilla, or if imaging identifies a concern, usually those are going to be biopsied with a needle to confirm the presence of malignancy. But those, the surgeons don't do the sentinel node sampling prior to the chemotherapy. We simply identify whether there's cancer there or not so that we are sort of heads up about that at the time of their ultimate surgery.
Yeah, so this would be a clinically node-negative axilla at the time they've got a biopsy. Should they have a sentinel lymph node biopsy done prior to the beginning of neoadjuvant? Pat, you want to take that question too?
Well, I think it's a little cumbersome to be taking a patient to the operating room to a sentinel node prior to neoadjuvant therapy. Majority of these can be diagnosed with ultrasound-guided FNA. And that's what we do. You know, I grew up in an era where you thought you could determine by physical exam whether nodes were positive or not. And I think we learned the hard way that that was not as reliable. Obviously, there are patients you can examine and you're sure that they're positive nodes. Even those patients, if you're going to embark on neoadjuvant therapy, you are better off documenting with pathology that those nodes are in fact positive. I'm going to touch base a little bit this afternoon on some of the questions that have arisen with management of the axilla in patients with known positive nodes after receiving neoadjuvant therapy. So you'll have to wait for that answer.
Comments about complications, surgical complications, wound issues after pre-op chemo radiation?
If you want to explain, they're not greater. The biggest dilemma that I have, usually I wait 4 weeks after surgery. My colleagues in medical oncology have tried to, you know, they point out that counts are back by 3 weeks and I could go ahead there. I've not found that there's a huge advantage to rushing a surgery because I think the effects of the chemotherapy probably last a little bit longer. The biggest issue I always have, and one of the things I've still struggled with, and I, over the years, have figured out just in my mind with the patient and their pathology, is who to do immediate reconstruction on after they've received neoadjuvant therapy. A lot has to do with whether or not you think those patients are going to get post-mastectomy chest wall radiation or not. But there, we've had good success in selected patients do an immediate reconstruction after neoadjuvant therapy. So yet one more sort of rationale for considering neoadjuvant therapy up front is they can go ahead and take care of that and then heal up, you know, prepare themselves for surgery and immediate reconstruction all in one step. Otherwise, quite often in patients with a little more advanced cancer, you know, if they would be taken to surgery first, most people wouldn't do immediate reconstruction. Then they go on to get their adjuvant chemotherapy, and it's only at some time later they can get reconstruction. But just in terms of wound complications, and I think we've shown this in multiple tumor types, the fear of complications related to the neoadjuvant therapy, whether it's combination of chemo and radiation, for the most part in the literature has been shown not to exist.
Okay. Dr. Grant, comments?
I totally agree.
Okay. Dr. Northfeld, comment? You don't do any damage for the surgeons then, right?
No, I feel
for
that...
I mean, you mentioned that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, the bevacizumab is an anti-angiogenesis agent, and it's been known for some time that it creates a lot of difficulty with wound healing. So people who get to surgery too soon after exposure to bevacizumab can have their wounds literally fall apart. And when it was first being seen, it was sort of a catastrophe that the surgeons had to regroup around. But now we're quite clear that somebody who's had bevacizumab ought to be waiting, you know, a minimum of 6 to 8 weeks before having an operation.
And I just want to make one comment before I forget, because I'm not really touching on some of the surgical aspects of patients receiving neoadjuvant therapy, but it is crucial if this patient is going to be a candidate for breast conservation prior to them going ahead and treating to make sure your radiologist has actually left a clip in the tumor. Quite often radiologists, when they do a biopsy, if you're dealing with a 5-centimeter spiculated mass, you know, they're not going to leave a clip in it because, yeah, who you know, why would we need a clip? These patients, we learned the hard way early on in our experience, is they would go on and get neoadjuvant therapy, and then you had to go back historically and try to figure out where the epicenter of that tumor was to do a proper lumpectomy.
If I have a 50 or 60% or greater likelihood of achieving complete pathologic response with preoperative chemotherapy, you're not going to find anything in the operating room. So it's routine in our practice when patients are receiving neoadjuvant therapy to have some kind of a marker placed so that the surgeon knows where to go later.
I just want to make a comment for the residents in the room. As you can see, our medical colleagues are trying to put people out of business. So, you know, eventually there's going to be a cure for AIDS, and there will definitely be a cure for cancer, but there's never going to be a cure for stupid. So trauma is the way to go for a career choice.
Okay, ever since Cain slaying Abel, right, we've been business on trauma. Okay, Dr. Northfeld, patients who have a complete course of neoadjuvant chemo, who preoperative, and do not have PCR, what is given to them post-op as an adjunct, and how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a very hot question in research. You know, if we not achieve pathologic complete response, then what? Well, it's most common not to achieve pathologic complete response in patients who have estrogen receptor expressing cancers. And of course, I have the answer for them. I'm going to put them on postoperative adjuvant endocrine therapy, either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. The bigger problem exists in those patients who have triple negative cancers or HER2 overexpressing ER negative cancers, and they come to surgery and have residual disease. There is currently no answer as to whether any further therapy is beneficial to those patients. There are attempts being made in the research realm to identify strategies that are going to be helpful to those patients. But I have to tell you, if we give a course of intense preoperative cytotoxic chemotherapy to somebody and they don't achieve a pathologic complete response, I'm very dubious that giving more chemotherapy is somehow going to make that situation better. That's almost certainly a cancer that's got some innate resistance to standard cytotoxic chemotherapy. So for me to imagine that I'm going to do something better for that patient with more of the same postoperatively, it's a pipe dream. There are strategies, as I said, I-SPY2 and other studies are investigating what strategies we could offer those patients postoperatively when we do see residual disease. It's probably going to require some novel approach, different kinds of drugs or different kinds of strategies. I'll tell you that I never want to leave a meeting like this without mentioning that there was a big, big study done that showed that reducing the quantity of fat in the diet of women with triple negative breast cancer reduces their relapse risk to a substantial degree. I don't know how much that information has penetrated into the world at large, but that was a big oral presentation at the San Antonio breast meetings back in December. Long-term results of an intervention that was started in late 1990s, where the goal was for women to reduce the quantity of fat calories in their diet down to 20%, the average in the U.S. being about 30%. And in that study, when women reduced their fat calories from 30% to 20% for 5 years, there was no advantage shown in reducing relapse risk in women who had ER-expressing cancers, ER-positive cancers. All the benefit in that study, and it was a statistically significant benefit, was shown in the group of women who had ER-negative cancers. So every woman who has a triple-negative breast cancer or an ER-negative HER2 overexpressing breast cancer needs to hear from somebody, the surgeon, the medical oncologist, the more the better, that she should reduce her fat calories as a way to reduce her relapse risk.
Okay, good thing. Comment about bilateral mastectomies, prophylactic in patients. Are you seeing an increase in the request? And how are you handling those that you don't believe are appropriate?
We're going to, I'm going to touch on that this afternoon. Okay. And I have a whole section on sort of contralateral prophylactic mastectomies.
While we're on the topic, pathologic complete responses, is it a reflection of the biologic activity of the tumor or the type of treatment that's being given? Can you say that it's an intervention related, or is it just defining a different biological activity?
Well, I think when we started employing anti-HER2 therapy against HER2 overexpressing cancers and saw these dramatic improvements in outcome, that's a clear indication that the scientists identified the true vulnerability of those cancers. In other words, they identified the true driver of those cancers, and when we interfered with that driver, we started having great success with HER2 overexpressing cancers. It's a little bit similar with the triple negative cancers. It was identified some time ago that many of those cancers have problem with DNA repair. And carboplatin, which is the drug that I was talking about earlier that showed the great advantage against triple negative breast cancers, the particular value of that drug is that it further impairs DNA repair in the cancer cell. So if that cancer cell is already a little bit labile in terms of its ability to repair DNA, and then you hit it even harder on that point, that's where we get our advantage. So the biology of these cancers is being very actively investigated as a way to identify treatments that are specific against those biologic quirks that those cancers have. What probably will happen ultimately is we'll have 20 different recipes or 40 different recipes for breast cancer, each defined by the particular biology of the cancer. And we'll have to do a lot of, you know, legwork at the beginning with our laboratory colleagues to identify those specific vulnerabilities. We'll have recipes for those vulnerabilities, and then you guys will be looking for new work.
So just one thing I want to mention in case somebody didn't ask it, and it's the most practical thing for y'all is, you know, what patient should you be referring when you've gotten the referral to, you know, for somebody to go to surgery, say, stop, I think we need to have you see medical oncology up front. You know, I'm in a setting where we all sit and review each case together, so it's sort of a no-brainer. But the question is, right now, who are the patients that absolutely should? Well, there's a whole group of patients that, you know, all you have to do is see them, and you know that they've got advanced disease, they got Peyton's, they got dermal lymphatic involvement. You should not be operating on those patients, inflammatory cancer. Those are the easy ones. Then, really, right now, it breaks down to probably more advanced disease that is either triple negative or HER2 positive. You know, one of the only downsides of the B18 protocol, which really was a great trial, is that it included everybody. So they just didn't isolate the bad actors, and that's why pre versus post probably, you know, have the same survival. But there's going to be a subset of patients that not only benefit just from getting a path CR and you are able to identify it, but there's probably a subset of patients that actually benefit from getting chemo right up front and then waiting for surgery later. So patients with, you know, stage 3 disease, patients with that are triple negative and or HER2 positive, those are the ones that we earmark to consider for neoadjuvant therapy up front. Not to mention, you know, stuff with improving your rates of breast conservation.
Dr. Grant, can you take that same question that Pat sort of posed to himself and apply it to the endocrine tumors? When should they be seeing medical oncology before?
Medical oncology for endocrine tumors?
Yeah. Is there any indication for it? Okay, next question. Is there any role for, or do you see any role for neoadjuvant therapy for any of the endocrine tumors?
That would be a stretch. The only one that comes to mind is an adrenal cortical cancer.
Okay.
That would be big, that frankly I think might really be unresectable unless you shrink it. In that circumstance that we have, that's rare. Even significant, big, invasive thyroid cancer, anaplastic, certainly, yeah. Anaplastic thyroid cancer should see a medical oncologist and a radiation oncologist ahead of time. Then you need to decide how you're going to go about that. And our approach then is to, if we think surgically we can debulk that in a really meaningful fashion without damaging significant functioning structures, we'd be willing to give away one recurrent nerve, but not all four parathyroids, not both nerves, and certainly not larynx, esophagus. So it really limits it for the anaplastic cancers, because they usually do that. And then we do need their help with pre-surgical treatment, but it's a combined effort and a joint decision.
Okay.
Can you think of others?
No, I agree. I can't think of any circumstance where we're going to help you that much.
Yeah. Follicular? No, at least in my experience, even if we have a patient, the classic is you find a lytic lesion in the bone, it's biopsied for some reason, it turns out to be metastatic follicular cancer, we would still do a thyroidectomy, because the idea then is you're facilitating the use of radioactive iodine in a systemic way, and you don't have the thyroid sink taking up the iodine that you want to deliver to the bone. So we would still do the thyroid up front. Certainly the medical oncologist, radiation oncologist would be involved, but not up front.
Nancy, there's a question for you. The question is, precautions or adaptations that you'd recommend for patients with an infuser pump, a port in place, rather. Okay. There was concern that it maybe get pinched or so.
But. Yeah, I could just comment on that. I think that in most circumstances it would be possible to secure the pump and the plumbing in a way that we could then deliver that patient to Nancy and say, just kind of modify the exercise strategy for that particular area of the body. I'm just trying to think of an example. Somebody who's got a port up here in this infraclavicular area, and that's being accessed, and that patient wants to exercise. Well, I'm not sure that, over-the-head presses are necessarily going to allow that to remain sufficiently motionless to keep that needle in place. But maybe that patient should, be walking on the treadmill or riding the stationary bicycle or something like that. But, I communicate those things to Nancy. If I'm sending somebody to her and they've got, some kind of impairment like that, physical or equipment-related, I just want to communicate that to her, and then she's very happy to go ahead and organize a treatment, an exercise strategy around that limitation.
That's what the referral is for.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's just like if I'm going to refer somebody to a surgeon or if I'm going to refer somebody to the radiation oncologist, my obligation really is to deliver that patient to them with a little bit of information. I'm sending this patient to you because they need a parathyroidectomy. I'm sending this patient to you because she needs an exercise prescription that takes into account the fact that she's going to have to wear a pump.
Okay. Last question, Dr. Fitzgibbon. After triple neurectomy for persistent groin pain after a hernia repair, your next step is mesh removal?
Well, whenever we do a triple neurectomy, we take everything out, everything that's in there, all the hardware, all the staples, we use fluoroscopy to get all the metal out, all the prosthetic material, because we only want to do this once. It's such a morbid operation.
And at that point, what do you do about the residual hernia defect?
Well, we try to do a conventional sutured repair. Sometimes the groin is so destroyed you have no choice but put something in like one of the synthetics or maybe even a biological.
Okay. And then do you then approach it from a posterior or preperitoneal approach or
both.
Transabdominal?
We do both. We use laparoscopy and a conventional open repair and explore the groin from both sides.
I think that everybody will agree that this was an excellent panel, and we very much appreciated the presentations. Thank you.